continuing with Mills on 26 August 76. You were mentioning that there was quite a bit of publicity about the 2C survey and its implications.
The cosmologists appeared to jump on it, of course, and the general picture that came back from the 55 Jodl Banks Symposium was relayed by Borzia, and I think Bolton was there too, if I remember correctly. I'm not sure about that, but anyway, I know Pawsey was. Was that it was creating enormous interest, and if it were taken seriously, of course, the implications were really, really very strong. And we knew that it was quite wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had perfect confidence in this, although one didn't have any great confidence in some of these weak sources that we had. It was quite obvious that the Cambridge 2C survey was wrong at a very much higher level than ours could possibly be. So it obviously had to be straightened out. We couldn't get through to Cambridge people, and this came strongly as reported by Pawsey, and of course I discussed this with him again as to what was the best thing to do, and we decided on this critical paper.
Did Pawsey, bring along strip charts and try to...
I can't remember whether he brought any... He didn't have any of mine with him.
That's what I meant.
No.
Yeah. But now you also mentioned Ryle had a popular article in Scientific American about this, and you felt compelled to write a letter to the editor.
Well, again, I think it was Bart Bott that suggested I do that. I actually not too happy about getting into public controversy, but this was one thing which was obviously terribly important.
Yeah.
I felt, and other people felt, that it should be straightened out, hence both the reply to Ryle in or my letter to Scientific American, and bringing out this paper.
Right. Now,
This paper was well advanced, of course, at the time of that letter, exchange in Scientific American.
Right, this was published, it was submitted in the same year as the other one was published, right. Now, did this survey get a lot of publicity in Australia or elsewhere?
Oh, yes. People were using it quite a lot, I think, at that time. But it didn't get the... its main publicity came as contradicting the 2C,
I think.
Oh,
yeah, right. But that's what I mean. Did it get a fair press?
Yes.
Fair
press.
Okay, let me just go through the paper and ask you a couple specific questions. You say that reliability of better than 90% for greater than 20 Janskys, as we now would say, they should all be included and completely reliable. But your catalog actually has a great number of sources between 7 and 20 Janskys.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Well, again, the purpose of the catalog was to produce a catalog of all concentrations of radio emission, and this was the thing which we were aiming at. We were not aiming at making sure we were cataloguing radio sources as such, point sources.
So you were just giving the reader
the whole
bit of data, and then just saying, well, I would choose
I would
to
believe
cut it
about 20.
Yeah. I see what you're saying. Okay, and you do a lot of analysis here on the effects of confusion and extended sources. And you end up saying that some 90-odd percent of yours are reliable and 98% of the Cambridge ones are not reliable, which, not quibbling about a few percent, basically turned out to be right.
Yeah.
Okay, here's the great difference in log N, log S. Although, I think that even your 20 Janskys, in retrospect, turns out to be a bit optimistic.
Well, as far as the point sources are concerned, it was okay. But there were a lot of extended sources which, in fact, turned out to be background irregularities, and some, I don't know how many, were probably sidelobe results. Most, I think, though, were, in fact, background irregularities.
And let's see, you're talking here about clustering of sources, and you think that you have a 0.02 result here, 2% chance of being random. Was that just a statistical fluke?
I think so.
It turned out.
Yeah.
Did you try to do this later with the entire survey?
Yes.
Didn't pan out.
I didn't get any significant results. It was just a fluke.
And here you talk about the problem of the background variability.
Yeah.
And you're trying to estimate how much noise this would add. I think that's.
The basic idea was, in effect, it was a crude P of D analysis. All I was doing was measuring the RMS background fluctuation and interpreting it in terms of the integrated effect of many sources. And this led to this sort of cosmological model.
And you come up with a density that turns out to be about 1,000 times that of Ryle and Scheuer. I figured that out.
Well, I think I suggested one possible cosmology which would fit, but I realized all this must be terribly preliminary, and it was just a matter of seeing if it was reasonable or not, which it was.
We therefore conclude that discrepancies in the main reflect errors in the Cambridge catalog, and accordingly deductions of cosmological interest derived from this analysis are without foundation.
Yeah.
But now here's something that a philosophical point. Analysis of our results shows that there's no clear evidence for any effect of cosmological importance in the source counts. But that's not true, because
It is true.
If you say that they're extragalactic and you have
Of cosmological importance. There were cosmological effects. But I don't think we couldn't demonstrate anything of cosmological importance in our accounts. You see the point?
One could argue this established that there was a Euclidean universe.
No. It merely say that we didn't go far enough to distinguish between different universes. I mean, every universe you start off counting looks Euclidean.
Yeah.
And it's only when you go to weak sources that you get cosmological effects coming in. No. This was my thought.
I see. So through your analysis, you had determined that you didn't really think that you were going deep enough, as you would say.
Or there may have been a population of more local objects, too.
So extragalactic, but
possibly. Anyway, local, shall we say. One couldn't distinguish in those days. You could say everything was distant extragalactic objects, but then we knew that some were not. We knew that M87 and 5128 were quite close extragalactic objects.
Right.
We had no clues about the luminosity function. There were not sufficient identifications to give a hint, except for Cygnus A, which suggested there were some very strong ones, but they may have been a very small proportion.
Mm-hmm.
And if things were all like M87, 5128, one wouldn't have got any cosmological information.
Mm-hmm.
We got nothing statistically different from a Euclidean slope, and the fluctuations in the background were such as could be explained by a fairly local population of extragalactic sources.
Okay.
So that, we didn't have anything really significant.
Did I hear you right, though, when you said that there was still some, in the back of your mind, some thought that they just might all be local within our galaxy?
Not all. There could be
a goodly fraction of them.
A dilution. Yeah, I still kept that as a possibility at that time.
Okay.
I didn't have any strong feelings about the necessity for them being cosmological or local at any time, I don't think. Not until we started doing lots of identifications and it became clear you could account for practically everything by extragalactic sources.
Okay. Another technical question. Were you aware at this time that a steady-state universe, in fact, would not predict 1.5 for the slope?
Well, in fact, if you take them sufficiently local, it does.
Well, no, but I mean, if you put in the redshift effect, for instance,
if you're looking at distant sources, again, no cosmology with redshift would predict 1.5, and I knew that. But it was a question of where this turnover occurred, you see. That was a crucial thing.
I guess the thing that I'm learning from you that I didn't realize is that you were really thinking that this, even that they were probably extragalactic, but that you weren't going deep enough to do cosmology.
Yeah, that was my thought, yes.
I hadn't quite seen that in the paper before.
Okay.
I'll have to reread it again. And therefore, you only say a couple things about cosmology. You don't try to put forth a whole cosmology of your own. You know. Okay. You brought up P of D. Now, the Cambridge people, in general, will say that after 2 or 3 years, they began to have to admit that 2C was pretty bad. But they hung on P of D. It seemed to be right, and it seems to me, you know, I haven't gone into every bit of analysis, but it seems to me that indeed history has shown that it was basically right. Would you agree with that, first of all?
Well, the measurements were obviously right, but they were open to several interpretations in those days.
Well, but I mean, the whole concept of a P of D analysis was a valid procedure.
Yeah. I think Minkowski put that very well when he said that the P of D carried information, but very low-grade information. And that, in fact, was our feeling.
Was that at the Paris Symposium, perchance?
No, that was a private comment to me, actually. He visited Sydney, actually, about this time we were finishing off this paper. And some of my conclusions there probably reflect my discussions with Minkowski about these things.
I see.
Particularly on the confusion problem. I know we had a number of discussions about that. Anyway, that was a bit of a diversion from your actual question.
Well, it seems to me that the outside world looked at P of D as sort of a rearguard action, trying to save what had been years of work, etc. Although it also seems to me that because it was so complex, that the outside world didn't really give it the chance it deserved, that it could establish some things.
No, I think we had a correct view of the importance of it, that it carried a lot of information, but I think Minkowski was right. It was low-grade information because you had to put a lot of assumptions into it. If you assume that sources were discrete point sources randomly distributed through the universe, it carried an enormous amount of information. But at that time, there was just no reason for assuming this.
I mean, right. You're still trying to establish that, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Only Cambridge knew this. No one else did. I mean, it was an assumption that went into the PFD. And as far as that assumption went, its conclusions were valid, and I quite accepted that. There may be a bit of discussion in the Paris Symposium about that on my part, because, you see, if the sources were not randomly distributed, if they were
And you had groupings, some indication of clustering
in
your
first... Yeah, I did, Then a PFD, all it can do is to set an upper limit on the population, because clustering increases the probability of deflection. And I was aware of this, so that this excess, which is also indicated by the P of D, could also simply indicate clustering. I mean, I discussed this with several people, and I think Minkowski and I were in fairly good agreement on this. I had spent a lot of time with him on it. And I didn't at all reject the importance of P of D analysis, but I then, and in fact to some extent still, feel that one has to be very cautious in interpreting what comes out. And then, and I think I would still say that P of D sets an upper limit on the distribution of point sources.
At any given flux level.
Yeah. But I don't think it can really set a lower limit because of the possibility of new populations coming in and the possibility of clustering on some scale which one hasn't been able to investigate. It's all an extrapolation from what one knows. And you should accept it, but you should accept it with a grain of salt. That was my very strong view in those days, and as I said, to some extent, I still believe this.
Well, you've mentioned the Paris Symposium. I've heard from many people that was a rather interesting meeting, to say the least.
Yeah, it was.
I suppose the interest was... I mean, one thing that interests me is that it was really the last time that virtually all the radio astronomers in the world could get together at one meeting.
Yeah.
So that you had a complete overview of the field. What struck you as one of the main participants as to the nature of that meeting?
Well, of course, I was particularly interested in the galactic and extragalactic work, not the solar
right.
stuff, so we won't talk about okay. that. But I think it settled a sort of way of outlook. I found that most people were now in agreement with what should be done and the problems of observation. Although Cambridge was fighting a rearguard action, it was recognized as a rearguard action. And their new survey was obviously going to be a lot right. better. And really, the ideas of synchrotron emission had become clear.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt it was really a sort of represented the peak of achievement up to that time.
Mm-hmm.
So all these ideas were now making sense. A lot of the earlier uncertainties had been completely resolved. There was this little bit of argument with Cambridge, but it wasn't, in my view, it wasn't a serious argument at that time. A really serious one was on the reliability of 2C, and that they had quietly
right.
dropped by then.
Right.
And I was quite prepared to go along with arguing mildly about some of the others,
mm-hmm.
which were not so clear. So I felt it was a very effective and very worthwhile meeting, which sort of summarized the present state very well.
But what about optical identification, though? That was still
That
was an unsettled question.
That was an unsettled question, yes, that's true. Dewhurst started doing some at that time. Bock had done, reported some. But there was nothing really systematic. And in fact, immediately following that meeting, I went to Pasadena again and spent 2 months doing identification work on a combination of our survey plus the 3C results, which were then available. And I used 3C for right ascensions and my positions for declinations, in fact.
Yeah.
And that is written up in that later paper you mentioned about 61 on the identification of radio sources. It took rather a long time to write up. I sometimes was rather tardy about writing up results when I knew what the answers were.
I don't think I have that one, because my bibliography ends in 60, so... So this is one that's by you alone?
Yes.
In Australian Journal of
Physics? You did find it somewhere on your list yesterday, I think, on the identification of radio sources. I think it was in 1960 published. It was Australian Journal of Physics.
Okay. Well, I'll check it out anyway.
Okay, well... That
came out of your stay in Pasadena.
Yes, and I think it was quite important, because it was really the first time that a proper luminosity function was produced. It wasn't a terribly accurate one then, of course, but... No, you had some data about it, giving the number of identifications with clusters and things like this, because I looked for all of them, the Abel
mm-hmm.
cluster identifications, as well as the radio sources. And... It was a systematic attempt, and Bolton and Minkowski had also been working. They'd started a bit later, but they published about the same time, getting essentially similar results. They all came out around about 1960,
right.
or early 61, I've forgotten when exactly.
But wasn't it discouraging to people like Minkowski that such a low percentage of these things were being identified?
Well, I think it was mainly challenging rather than discouraging.
Well, I mean, Dewhurst has told me, you know, that he went over and spent 6-9 months looking at all these 3C fields and coming up with such a small percentage of...
Of course, one of the troubles with the 3C, even then, was that there were a large number of lobe shifts in them, and a lot of the positions were quite unrelated to
right.
the...
Well, he looked plus and minus one lobe shift also.
Yeah. I think we may have overlapped there. A time, or he may have been there a little before me. I think we overlapped for a time. But certainly, I was quite happy with the results I got out of it. And I think, as I said, that both Bolton and Minkowski continued on later on with even more better positions and got basically similar results. And a lot of the later identifications were summarized in that first paper. There was a horrible blue in it, incidentally, in the appendix, but never mind, you're not interested in things like that, I guess.
A horrible
mistake, just a mathematical slip.
In the appendix of which?
Calculating source counts in various cosmologies.
In which paper, though?
In this paper I'm talking about, my identification paper.
I see.
It didn't alter any of the basic conclusions. It was just a source of embarrassment later on.
Okay. Yeah. Back to the Paris Symposium, you also talked about the corona of our galaxy, thermal and non-thermal emission, and so forth. Class 2 radio sources being non-thermal. I would gather that you would say that this was beginning to become settled in your mind.
Yes. I think by then I had an overall picture, which was of radio galaxies being the type 2 sources that I had, and supernova remnants and H2 regions being the type 1, basically. Mm-hmm. And the galactic corona that I had was sort of grew out of Shklovsky's suggestion, but the model which I produced was quite different, and quite different from the one really which Baldwin produced earlier. It was much smaller and flatter.
How did that come about?
Well, I was using southern hemisphere data around the plane rather than northern hemisphere data around the pole, and it was just a different data.
Right.
But they were not all that different. Everyone seemed to agree at that time there was a lot of emission at high high distances above the plane, high Z distances. And this was questioned later on, and it's clear that my separation was probably gave too much to the high Z radiation.
But anyway, there was general agreement that there was a lot of halo in some sense.
In some sense,
you were arguing about its detailed shape.
Yeah.
About the whole controversy over 2C and so forth, it seems to me that there was, would you agree with this, that there was a tremendous mixture of arguments going on. There was the validity of P of D as a check, which independent of confusion effects. There was the level of confusion in the two surveys. Percentage of extended sources and how this would influence NFS. Different Fourier frequencies sampled, how this influenced NFS. Then steady state versus evolving cosmologies got dragged in. And what should be counted as a source. All these things, and often the arguments got cross-circuited.
Yeah. It was a very confusing period, really. I think we all had our ideas one way or another. And it's pretty hard to work without working hypothesis, which you pick up. But the arguments were only heated, I think, when there's a question of the real, whether 2C was basically right or wrong. Now, that was one which was settled. But it was very, very heated arguments about that at one time.
Right.
But the others... And then there was always a heated argument on the question whether the steady state could be shot down by the radio data. And there I tended to feel for a very long time that it couldn't be, that there wasn't sufficient precision in the radio, or the populations involved in the radio information were not sufficiently defined to shoot down the steady state. I think you know what's happened since then, but at that time we were really very ignorant about what class of source we were dealing with.
So you would say that those were the two...
Yeah, they were the heated ones, yes, because of personalities, basically.
Right. Okay. Well, just a couple more here. You also made a survey with the cross of the galactic plane, which was Hilsley and Mills in 58. And what did this show?
Well, the basic thing, the interesting things that came out of that, of course, were the steps in the distribution suggesting.
That's right. I'm sorry, I forgot that that was the paper that.
Yeah.
Yes. That was in the Paris Symposium also?
Yes, that was mentioned I produced a spiral arm model there, which actually sort of hung around for quite a long time
That's
afterwards,
right.
because In fact, the radio steps did correspond to regions where one was looking along the major spiral arms.
Were you being influenced by all of the H1 work going on?
No, not at all then. That was purely a... That particular interpretation is purely based on looking at my results and seeing, we've got steps there, that they must be...
It wasn't talking with Frank Kerr at tea or something like that?
No, not that one.
I always thought that.
Sat down and read up about spiral arms and saw that the one possible interpretation was a logarithmic spiral, a good thing to fit, tried to fit it, and it did.
But did you know about the H1 work?
Oh, yes, I knew that the, of course, spiral arm...
This whole method of getting distances...
In those days, the spiral arm, H1 spiral arm, and that was just an unholy mess. It was not circular.
It still is, but if
you've looked at some of the old maps, you'll realize that those days it was even worse. And I think many people felt that it was the interpretation of the distance was very difficult, and this occurred to me as being a possible way of getting a model without that. If the spiral arms were basically logarithmic spirals, and all you had to do was to fit to the tangential directions, and you had it.
But of course that was a big if.
At least in one case of our own galaxy.
Mm. Yeah. You mentioned that the Paris Symposium was a rather nice synthesis of many things that had been going on over the previous years. At that time, what did you see as the main thrust that needed to be done for galactic and extragalactic radiation? I mean, what direction needed to be traveled?
The extragalactic was clearly... The identification was the essential thing. I mean, I think everyone believed that at the time, which in fact was why I went back and did it, or did some of it. But that I thought was the most important on the extragalactic side. Obviously, higher resolution was a real basic necessity too, and I was then thinking about a larger instrument which would help to overcome, give more precise positions and better resolution.
This is what eventually became the Molongalo.
Yes, that's
cross.
Right, yes. There was a vague suggestion by then that high-frequency work was going to become important. And again, we were then thinking of what is now the Parkes dish as this big steerable high-frequency dish. And these seem to be the important, but mainly for the extragalactic work, but also for the galactic work, it was clear that high frequency was extremely important, and again, one wanted high resolution. So these were both reflected by the Parkes reflector and the Molongalo dish. These represented the continuing along and doing what we felt had to be done.
Right.
And on the galactic side, I don't know that I wasn't so terribly interested in the galaxy then, but this became a thing which interested me more later on.
About this time, I believe that something had to give in terms of big proposals for CSIRO, is that right?
Yes.
Could you tell me about that?
We had the... three proposals around 59-50-60 for Weyl's ring-type instrument, for a big cross, and for the large steerable reflector. That had been on the books ever since 52-53, and the chief protagonist for a large steerable reflector was Teddy Bowen, the director. And there was obviously, this was necessary. No, I didn't argue about that. This was number one priority, and we simply had to have that. So, but when funds were absorbed for that, available funds, very little was left for anything else. And again, solar astronomy obviously needed more instrumentation, so that there's a very strong case for Paul Weill's instrument. So that, again, I couldn't really argue with it. That really should be second priority.
You're not saying you didn't try to argue.
Oh, no. Well, I think perhaps there were some basic arguments whether it was worth pursuing solar astronomy at all. But given that it was worth pursuing,
obviously,
had to do it with that sort of instrument. Of course, he was the one who had to make that decision. And in fact, he made it that solar astronomy had to continue. I would have been quite happy to see it not, of course. That was just my own personal view. So therefore, there was very little chance with our money available and our facilities to also continue with the cross. So that since I felt it was most important to go for very high resolution and sensitivity, and my analysis then had shown that the steerable dish wouldn't do this. It was not intended. At that time, we had no thought that it would go much beyond 10 centimeters, and receivers in those days were pretty poor at high frequencies, although the maser had come along, and this looked as if it would make a big boost for high frequency work. It still looked as if that really wasn't what was necessary for surveying of radio sources and for precise position measurements. I felt that the cross-type instrument was the best for that particular type of operation. I felt we had to do it, so I just looked around to where I could find some support.
Right.
And I did find it in Sydney University.
And so when did you move there?
1960, about mid-1960, or towards the end of 1960.
So this was this after all the MSH survey?
It had all been published then, yes.
Well, it hadn't been published.
It had been 60, I think the last paper came out in 1960. It had all been done anyway.
Well, it had all been done, okay.
Yes.
Maybe the final paper wasn't actually there.
It may have been 61 that came out.
Right, and then you began working on the design and the funding and so forth for what became the Longo Cross,
yes,
is that right?
Yes, that's right, yes.
And just very briefly, when was that built and when
it
operated and so forth?
It started in 62 when we got our first infusion of funds from America. And it was fully completed in 67. It was operating as one arm was operating for some years before that. But the north-south arm was a very difficult engineering problem with a one-mile-long phased feed system.
Oh, yeah.
And that was 67 before that was actually fully operational.
You bring up a point which I'd like to ask about. Namely, I didn't realize that some American money had gone into the Longo Cross. Was this Ford Foundation?
No, NSF.
NSF?
Yes, they gave the...
Those are the halcyon days when they were giving money to Australians.
In total, they gave about $1 million.
But also, it's my understanding that American money basically made the Parks dish possible. This was the Ford Foundation.
Yes, yes.
And Kogura.
Yes.
Was this Ford Foundation also?
The Carnegie Institute, I think, gave the Parks money, and the Ford Foundation, the Kalgoorlie instrument, if I remember correctly.
But why is there this recalcitrance, apparently, on the part of the Australian government to come forth with the goodies, when obviously, if you had to name, I think, one science in which Australia has excelled, puts them on the scientific map, this is it.
Well, a prophet in his own country has little honour, I think, and this applied exactly in this field.
Yeah.
Some overseas people were prepared to acknowledge Australian science by putting money into it. They were prepared to put some too, although they didn't put any into mine, but still. This was the attitude, rather funny, but here we are. I think basically the politicians couldn't believe that anything worthwhile would come out of Australian science.
Really? So you're saying this is not confined to radio astronomy?
It tends to operate over all science, although they have provided a lot of money before that for optical astronomy in building a 74-inch telescope. They had provided funds for high-energy accelerator, Oliphant's enormous homopolar generator, which consumed a large amount of money. And it could be that they built the there had to be some limits in the amount anyway. We couldn't interest the government in providing direct support for but without some stimulation from outside.
Well, early 60s is about where I'm ending things, and I thank you very much for your time. So that ends the interview with Mills on 26 August 76.